high stakes. We're talking $215 million, money in a trust that heiress Abigail Cabana-Nacoa is fighting to control. That was the subject of a court ruling. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was there when the verdict was handed down yesterday. So, Ryan, it was a bit of a mixed bag.
That's right, Catherine. So to outline it, on opposite sides of the courtroom were Abigail Cabana-Nacoa herself. She's the heir to the $215 million fortune from the James Campbell estate, sugar plantation money. And she was joined by her wife, Veronica Gale Worth. And on the other side of the courtroom were board members from the Cabana-Nacoa Foundation, which is the trust that controls that money, and some attorneys representing domestic workers from that estate. Cabana-Nacoa's longtime attorney, James Wright, was named trustee of the trust, and she has since tried to replace him as a controlling member of the trust, and replace him with several other people, including her wife, Veronica Gale Worth. The board members of the foundation have sued to prevent that, saying that there's undue influence on the part of Abigail's wife, and that they're trying to take control of the money that should be used, as they say, to benefit Native Hawaiians. So the central question before the judge, Judge Mark Browning, was whether or not Abigail Cabana-Nacoa is mentally fit to make those decisions, and whether James Wright was allowed to be fired, and should she be allowed to name trustees to control this fortune. And here's what he had to say.
Ms. Cabana-Nacoa did not and does not either at the time of her discharge from the hospital on June 25th, 2017, or presently have the mental capacity to serve as trustee and manage her own financial affairs. The court approves and adopts the findings of the special master that Ms. Cabana-Nacoa does not presently have the mental capacity to serve as trustee of her trust. In applying the standards set forth in Anderson and Lentz, the court finds, one, that the requisite capacity to amend Ms. Cabana-Nacoa's trust depends upon the content and the complexity of the proposed amendment. More complicated amendments require a higher level of capacity, while less complicated amendments may only require testamentary capacity. Ms. Cabana-Nacoa lacks the requisite capacity needed to revoke her trust. Ms. Cabana-Nacoa lacks the requisite capacity to replace the trustee of her trust, but has the capacity, requisite capacity, to remove. The court grants the request to remove Mr. Wright as successor trustee, denies the request that Ms. Cabana-Nacoa be permitted to name her own trustees through her new financial capacity. First Hawaiian Bank is appointed successor trustee upon the filing of acceptance of appointment. The special master is directed to contact First Hawaiian Bank to obtain the acceptance appointment to facilitate the transfer of assets from Mr. Wright to the First Hawaiian Bank.
So, Catherine, a lot to unpack there, but to distill it as simply as possible, the judge made a split decision. One of the most complicated aspects of this case is that Hawaii state law does not have a standard for this matter, for the cognitive bar, basically, that one needs to meet to make decisions about a trust. So he had to look at law in other jurisdictions and other states to try and make a decision. And so he decided that there were multiple standards that had to be met for different actions. Basically, it was an acknowledgement that some actions are more complex than others and therefore require a higher standard of mental fitness and mental competency.
So what was the reaction from her attorney?
Michael Lilly was her attorney. Mixed reaction. They were happy that James Wright was removed. That was what they were wanting. But they did not get the other aspect of the case that they wanted, which was for Abigail Cabana-Nacoa to be able to name trustees. And so here's what Michael Lilly had to say.
We're gratified that Mr. Wright has been removed, but what our next steps are, I can't comment. We're disappointed that her trustees weren't approved, but removal of Mr. Wright was the right thing, and we're glad the judge did that. The most important thing has always been Ms. Cabana-Nacoa. This is her estate, her life. She has a loving marriage. She's a private person, and to be put on in the news for a year, to have her personal affairs discussed publicly, has been outrageous and sad. And she really is entitled to be left alone. And so let her leave her alone. She knows what she's doing. So she's very, in my mind, she's very competent.
So, Catherine, there you hear Abigail Kawana-Nakoa's attorney, Michael Lilly, rebuffing the judge's decision that she wasn't fit to do to make some decisions regarding the trust. Next, let's hear from Megan Cao. She was the attorney representing the domestic workers who worked in the home of Abigail Kawana-Nakoa, and they provided testimony to the special master investigating all of this regarding the influence of Veronica Gale Worth, who is Abigail's wife.
I'm ecstatic. I'm shocked. I can't believe it. You know, all the status conferences that we had and the court appearances in between, it sounded like the court was going to go the other way. What he said is that basically she has a little bit of capacity in order to remove a trustee, but not enough capacity to appoint a trustee. And so from here on out, I mean, this decision is so significant, but because from here on out, First Hawaiian Bank will be the trustee of the Abigail Kawana-Nakoa Trust.
So you heard there Megan Cao, attorney on the opposing side, and the judge basically declined to comment extensively on this allegation that there was undue influence from either Abigail's wife or the things that the domestic workers had commented that they had witnessed, instead sticking to the more narrow scope of her cognitive ability. We're also going to hear next from Lilikala Kame'elehiva, who is one of the board members of the foundation, and she was trying to prevent Ms. Kawana-Nakoa from being able to appoint trustees.
I think we're all going to keep our eyes on it, but I trust First Hawaiian Bank to do a good job, actually. Their reputation's at stake, and they've done some good things in the past. So I'm relieved. I just think the most important thing is that the judge has realized that Abigail Kawana-Nakoa needs to be protected, that he's got her best interests at heart. I think I can say for all of us, that was our first and foremost idea and wish, is that she would be protected.
All sides, including the judge, stated that their most important, the most important thing to them was the welfare and the best interests of Abigail Kawana-Nakoa. And although they were opposing each other on multiple points of the case, everybody professes to be looking out for her despite their opposition to each other.
It's kind of uji. It's sad because she's sitting there and listening to both sides, you know, talk about her and talking about her money.
That was really one of the most striking things about the whole thing, is that while all of these attorneys and different parties are talking about the mental fitness of Abigail, she was sitting right there the entire time, and you could see her visibly grimace on multiple occasions, which was totally understandable. Unclear whether or not she and her attorneys will challenge the ruling. They're going to be meeting with the judge. Both sides will be meeting with the judge in the coming weeks to determine the way forward. But as of right now, a split decision from the judge gave both sides something, and First Hawaiian Bank is now in control of the $215 million estate.
All right. Thanks, Ryan. That was The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty with the latest twist in the long saga involving trust money, some of which were going to benefit Native Hawaiian groups. Playing out like a soap opera, is this the end of it? Stay tuned. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Ulana, For today's quiz, we delve into Hawaii's political backyard to test your knowledge of Honolulu's longest-serving mayor, Frank F. Bossy. He was born August 27, 1920, in East Hartford, Connecticut, and graduated from Trinity College before serving as a Marine in the South Pacific in World War II. He was briefly stationed on Kauai. Now, in 1956, he resigned his commission as captain in the Marine Corps Reserves. He moved to Honolulu, where he started a very successful contracting, building, demolition, and salvage company. His political career is a long list of accomplishments. Here are some early highlights. In 1958, he won his first Hawaii election, a seat in the Territorial Senate. In 1964, he was elected to the Honolulu City Council. His first term as Honolulu mayor came in 1968 when he defeated D.G. Andy Anderson, who in later years became his managing director. In the many campaigns that Fossey ran, they were either primary or general races, but one year he tossed his hat into the ring for a special election. For today's question, what was that race and who won? You think you know? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right. Tropical storm Olivia has cast a wide net of uncertainty after what we saw with Hurricane Lane. The Hawaii State Department of Education canceled classes at Hana High and Elementary School today, as well as all after-school activities and programs on Maui campuses. Among those intently watching the storm are scientists preparing for a research expedition out to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. University of Hawaii biologist Chris Kelly is planning to leave this week to begin charting a seamount in Papahanao, Makuakea.
I'm going to be going out on a ship called the Nautilus, and this ship is owned and operated by the Ocean Exploration Trust, which is a foundation that was founded by Bob Ballard, who discovered the Titanic. And they just happened to be out here in Hawaii, lucky for us, and they want to do some operations in the monument. They're actually off the Big Island right now doing some dives off of the Lauihi volcano. But then when they get back to Oahu in another day or so, then we're going to get ready to head on up to the Papahanao Makuakea Marine National Monument and do a bunch of work up there.
Okay, so tell us, how is this storm, Olivia, affecting the operation?
Well, it's Mother Nature. But Olivia has already caused a possible delay in when we depart, because when there is a tropical storm here close to shore, then normally the Coast Guard will order the ships out of port because it's safer them to be out at sea. And the Nautilus crew is expecting that to happen. So we may get delayed by 12 hours on our departure on Friday, or even more than that, depending on what the storm does in the next couple days.
Okay. So what do people need to know if they kind of want to track to see what you're doing out there?
Well, those of you who are interested, then you can go to nautiluslive.org. And there's also a Twitter feed as well. And you can get, if you check there, there'll be a message that says the Nautilus is in port or out at sea waiting for the end of the storm, or the Nautilus is heading to the dive site, get ready, you know, something like this. And so they can follow what's going to happen.
And you've been out on this ship before?
No, this is the first time for this ship. I've been out on a lot of other ships, but first time for this one.
Okay. And so in the past, though, I know you've gotten some incredible video. You had sightings of some unusual creatures out there.
Yes, and we're hoping to sight some more unusual critters out on these seamounts. So where we're going, it's a set of seamounts that have never been mapped before and never been dove on before, and they're inside the expanded area of the monument. So in 2016, President Obama expanded the Papahanao Makuakea boundaries from 50 miles from the emergent land masses to the 200-mile U.S. exclusive economic zone. And when he did that, then he enclosed a whole bunch of features that no one had ever explored before, because most of the work was concentrated in the monument over the years by the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory and other institutions. But now we've got a whole lot of a whole lot more seafloor to explore and to try to help the monument understand what the resources are in this new area.
So it's new virgin territory.
New virgin territory. And this particular group of seamounts we chose because not only are they potentially interesting from the biology that could be there, but they are very interesting geologically because they're forming a line. Okay, and kind of like the Hawaiian archipelago, it sort of forms a line and keeps going up to the northwest. This is because the Hawaiian Islands were formed from a hot spot that's existing right now right off of the Big Island and is responsible for the volcanic activity that we had a few months ago. Anyway, these hot spots typically form sort of a linear chain of islands and banks and volcanoes and seamounts and so forth as the Pacific Plate moves toward the northwest. So this particular group of seamounts that we're going to dive on, and there's 10 of them, they're in a line that parallels the Hawaiian archipelago, but there's no hotspot there. And they're not in an orientation that indicates that they might have been created many, many years ago back in the Cretaceous. Like, there are some really old seamount trails, much older than the Hawaiian trails, that are in our neighborhood. But this is parallel to the Hawaiian chain, and it doesn't make any sense except for one possibility, and it's what's called arch volcanism. And I knew what it was, but I never knew that it could create seamounts before, because most of the work that's been done to explore this type of volcanism, which I'll mention in a moment, has happened off of the Big Island, and it's resulted in sort of this lava lake or field on the seafloor. And what I'm talking about is that when you get a very large volcano forming, like, for example, the Big Island right now, there's weight on this island, and there's weight on this volcano, and it's pressing down on the crust. Earth's crust. And Earth's crust is rigid, but it's a little bit flexible, too, so it actually bends. And when it bends, it creates a little bit of a trough around the islands, but then that also causes a bulge further out, something like about 100 miles or so out from the islands. And if the weight is heavy enough, then where it creates that sort of bulge, which is called an arch, then it could essentially crack the seafloor open and you get lava oozing out. But it's never been documented to produce seamounts. It's kind of the slow oozing type of lava. But that can be, as far as we know, it's the only explanation for how these seamounts could have formed. And so it's going to be unprecedented. We're going to collect a lot of rocks there and try to figure it out.
Do you think there's a greater chance of seeing more sea life there or not?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So this particular line of seamounts is right between Gardner and some of the other in the Hawaiian archipelago, and also a set of seamounts that not very many people know about that's called the Musician Seamounts that's further to the northeast. And so this small little line that we're going to go to is right between these two places, and we've found fantastic communities of corals and sponges both in the Musicians and in the Hawaiian archipelago in the original monument itself. And so we're expecting to see the same type of thing on these seamounts. And every time you go on one of these seamounts, they're all different. You never know what creatures are going to be there.
And I think when I last interviewed you, you were on the Okeanos?
Yes.
And so what do you remember from that trip?
Oh, I have fantastic memories from the Okeanos. Spectacular video. And we were diving very, very deep. Usually below 2,000 meters or 6,000 feet all the way down to 6,000 meters, close to 20,000 feet down. And we're seeing so many strange, unusual animals. And the Okeanos experience was fantastic because they broadcast the video live via telepresence. Well, so does the Nautilus, this ship that we're going to go out, so that people can go to the Nautilus website and they can see the video in real time as we see it. So when we come across something new and see it and get all excited, they're going to see it for the first time as well.
And that's the neat thing about technology.
Yeah, the technology is astonishing because they have a satellite dish on the ships, the Nautilus as well as the Okeanos Explorer, and it takes the feed from the remotely operated vehicle that's down on the seafloor. It's that feed is the video feed. It's high definition video feed is brought up through a cable. Then it's sent to a satellite dish, and the dish sends it up to a satellite, which then goes back to a special facility in Rhode Island, which then processes or somehow, I don't know how it works, but then that facility distributes the video over the internet to everybody.
And it really is amazing. I mean, you started out with Hurl, and you know that that was just a, you know, a fabulous experience to be able to get these images from deep down. But we had to wait for, you know, for some time for you folks to download the video.
Yes. Yeah, that's a bit of an issue. So the difference from my Hurl days, the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory days, which, by the way, is the University of Hawaii here, is that we used submersibles, manned submersibles, that weren't cabled or tethered to the ship. So we would go down and we would record the video on, you know, hard drives and things like this. And then we would have to, if we're out for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, we'd have to get back in port before we could show the video to anybody. But with these other ships, the Okeanos and the Nautilus, they don't use manned vehicles. They use unmanned vehicles that are cabled to the ship. So the video can get sent up the cable in real time and distributed to everybody in the world.
Right. So there are pluses there, but there are also some minuses because you probably can't go to some places that the manned submersibles could go to, right?
That's right. So the manned submersibles, they don't have a tether, so they're more flexible in very tough, steep terrain, which we've encountered in plenty of places. Cabled vehicles always have to be careful where their cable is, because if they get snagged and they can't unsnag themselves, that's millions of dollars of expensive equipment that's going to get lost. So, yeah, they can't go everywhere. But they, after 3 years working with the Okeanos Explorer, they can go to a lot of places, and we got onto some pretty steep terrain.
Right, right. And the Hurl subs are mothballed for now.
Yeah, unfortunately. You know, part of the problem was the ship is ready for dry dock. It needs some more repairs, and it's very, very expensive to operate these ships. And the KOK, the Kaimikai o Kanaloa, which is the university ship, has been around for decades and decades and was extremely productive for many years. But every ship eventually
shows her age.
Yeah, kind of like me. So anyway, that's the situation. The subs are in perfect working order, but that ship is the only ship that we had that could deploy those subs.
Right. So that's kind of a loss, but noteworthy to mention in the history of marine science and exploration.
Yes, absolutely. But there's a slight bright spot in that the University of Hawaii acquired a new remotely operated vehicle themselves called the Lu'ukai, and it just completed a very successful cruise down to the manganese nodule field southeast of here. And so the University of Hawaii is still in the game, even though it's probably is not going to be operating the subs much more, if at all. We've got this other vehicle which is going to be working.
Right, so the experienced team can still be put to work.
That's correct. And they are transitioning over. And, you know, of course, there's always a thrill when you're going down yourself
right.
something. So it's a little different. But then there's also some pluses.
Right, the technology and to be able to share that experience with just anybody online.
That's correct. And so, yeah, it's just different. But we're still getting to explore the deep sea and see all types of weird things.
Okay, so if folks want to jump in and share the adventure, they just have to kind of watch Olivia and keep up to date with the website so we know when you folks are actually going out there on the dives, because it may not be till next week.
That's correct. So we were, if Olivia does not interfere with our plans right now, then we plan to leave on Friday morning, and we've got 3 days of transit to get up to the dive site, and then we're going to map the first seamount on the fourth day. So our first dive would be on the fifth day, which is the 19th, I believe. But if Olivia causes some delay, which I expect it will, then that might get pushed back by a couple of days.
That was biologist Chris Kelly getting ready to embark on a mission to chart a seamount in Papahanaumokuakea later this week. You can find out more about this expedition on the Conversations Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Chamber Music Series. The Parker Quartet performs Beethoven's Harp Quartet and Janacek's Kreutzer Sonata this Friday at UH Orvis Auditorium. HonoluluChamberMusicSeries.org.
My wife Judy, who sings with several choirs, and I were heading into town in the car, listening to the radio, and suddenly Beethoven's Ode to Joy came on, and Judy started singing along. It was a magical moment because Beethoven's Ode to Joy was on the radio, and only with HPR would that ever happen. My name is Harlan Hughes, and my wife is Judy Anderson. We live in Kula on the slopes of Haleakala, and we are very proud to be sustaining members of Hawaii Public Radio.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Chad Bear Blair joins us with the latest on the strike vote taken by members of the hotel workers. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, yeah, this is a big deal.
It is. We're talking about 3,500 Local 5 workers who could strike at any moment. They did take a vote basically saying we're ready, we're prepared to do this. Overwhelming majority of the workers voted in favor of giving this authorization to Local 5, the union. And, boy, the reason it's such a big deal is because it includes a lot of very important properties, particularly in Waikiki, the Royal Hawaiian, the Moana Surfrider, the Sheraton Waikiki. I believe there's a Sheraton on the Sheraton on Maui as well. So it's not just confined to Oahu. But they are willing to, if you will, put on the red shirts and start walking up and down Kalakaua, as they have done before, to get what they say are their demands in terms of their contract.
Yeah, I was out there on Labor Day when they rallied in front of the Marriott there in Waikiki. And, yep, it was a lot of red shirts.
Yeah, and then signs and chanting, and I'll say this for Local 5, they're very good at organizing and making themselves heard, and you can imagine how uncomfortable that might make some of the hotel operators. By the way, the hotels aren't saying very much. Some talk about respecting, of course, union rights. They are saying in a statement that they will continue to make sure their guests have good experiences. But no comments on the specific of the contract. The contracts, by the way, for these workers expired in June, and there's a bunch of things that the union wants to have on the table.
Yeah, I know when I talked with Eric Gill, I know he had said they had last talked with the Marriott, I think it was the week before Labor Day,
right.
And they had another session planned with Kyoya, I think it was last week, Friday. So,
yeah, and Eric Gill's the secretary treasurer of Local 5. I mean, among other things, they'd like to have an across-the-board pay raise, $3 an hour. They also want to negotiate the number of rooms that a housekeeper has to clean. They would like to have some retraining, given changes in the industry. Even issues like sexual harassment policies. These are the kinds of things that Local 5 wants to talk about. But their main goal, boiled down to one statement, this is coming from Mary Gill, they want to be able to have one job that's enough to support them to live in Hawaii. No easy thing, given the cost of living here.
That's right. And he told me that I think the housekeepers make like $22 an hour, but that's not enough, given our average price of a home is $800,000.
Yeah, that just happened this week. And we should just point out the tourism industry is booming. $1.6 billion in visitor spending. That was in July. That was up nearly 5% from 2 years ago. An average room in Waikiki, it's about $230. And the occupancy is good. About 80% of those rooms are full generally. So Gill is saying, look, things are booming for the bosses, but they're not booming for the workers.
Right. They want to share in the profits.
Yes, exactly.
And I know that they've said that, yeah, one job should be enough, and it's not.
No, it's not. And you talk to some of these workers, and many of us, I'm sure, listening right now could appreciate how a lot of us have to have more than one job to get by in this very expensive state.
I know, being out there at that rally, I was struck that, yeah, a lot of workers, and they really are the backbone of Waikiki.
Absolutely.
Yep, lots of give and take in the tourism industry, so we'll see what plays out in the next couple of weeks.
Thanks, Catherine.
All right. Thanks so much, Chad. That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's reality check. To read the full story by Stuart Yerton, visit civilbeat.org. Getting underway at this hour is a ceremony at Tamarind Park marking the 70th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attack on our country and the loss of so many first responders in that event. Close to 3,000 people died that day, including several Hawaii residents. Most families and friends are marking the day in quiet and personal ways. One of those that died that day was Christine Schneider, an arborist for the Outdoor Circle. Several trees were planted in her honor and are still thriving, including a banyan that had to be relocated within Kapi'olani Park. We talked to the Outdoor Circle's Steve Meckler about remembering Christine Schneider, who had been attending a conference on the East Coast and had just jumped on a return flight home to Hawaii.
She had gone back to New York. Mary Steiner, who was our executive director, and Chris had gone back to a conference on the East Coast, and they were on their way back to Hawaii, but on separate flights. Mary was staying longer on the East Coast, and Chris was flying back to Honolulu, and Chris was on flight 93. So she was one of the 40 people that went down, you know, 17 years ago.
And that was the one in Pennsylvania?
Correct.
Okay, because that was where the passengers tried to overcome the
the
terrorists.
The passengers overtook the plane and brought it down in the field, so that plane didn't go on to Washington and do whatever was planned by the group that had taken over the plane. So they stormed the cockpit and brought the plane down.
So how does an organization like the Outdoor Circle handle the anniversary like this when it comes around?
We set up a memorial fund in Chris Snyder's name. It was an educational fund. And there were contributions that were made in Chris's name. Those monies have been used over the past 17 years to fund various projects that the Circle has undertaken, from tree mapping exceptional trees to the Citizen Forester Program, where we've been mapping the trees around the city and county of Honolulu as part of a program that we've been a partner with, which is Trees for Honolulu's Future, which is trying to increase the shade canopy from 23% to 33%, so it's, which is part of this global warming strategy to reduce the impact of global warming by actually creating a greater shade canopy in our city and county of Honolulu. So all of the funds that have been donated to the Chris Schneider Educational Fund have been utilized for programs like that that are returned essentially to the community for programs in Chris's name. She was really the consummate environmentalist, really ahead of her time. Before there were names put to programs like this, because this was, you know, essentially 20 years ago that she was very involved. Not only was she a terrific person, she was one of the consummate environmentalists. She was one of the earliest certified arborists, female certified arborists in the country. And she took it upon herself to get involved in a number of different kinds of projects, both here and domestically in the rest of the country. So she really assisted the Outdoor Circle in those goals of really bringing environmental awareness to the public's attention and assisting the Outdoor Circle in its goals of educating the public about environmental awareness. Her spirit is always with the staff and volunteers of the Outdoor Circle. We've got, you know, a very dedicated staff and a very committed system of 10 branches of the Outdoor Circle. So her work, you know, lives on through all of our activities that we get involved with. Each of the branches has their own particular agendas that they follow based on what the goals of their particular communities want. But Chris was very dedicated to following the mission statement of the Outdoor Circle, which is to keep Hawaii clean, green, and beautiful. And that was her mission statement also is to follow those founding principles of the Outdoor Circle, which is, you know, over 107 years old now. We're always looking for donations to keep that fund going. Obviously, we've been utilizing the funds the best way we can, but you know, as we use them, the fund gets depleted. So on days like this where we do think back as to what her goals were and the memory of what she did for the Circle and what she has done for our community, you know, maybe it is a time that we think back and say, boy, I would really like to remember what Chris did for our community and make a pledge to the Outdoor Circle through that Chris Snyder Educational Fund to help with furthering the goals that she held so strongly towards. It's a living legacy, and you know, we're sort of the administrators of that particular fund, and with each donation, plant a tree. So that's what we try to do. That's what the Outdoor Circle does, is you know, keeping Hawaii green and beautiful for future generations.
That was Steve Meckler with the Outdoor Circle, remembering Honolulu's Christine Snyder, who died in a Pennsylvania field on 9/11, 17 years ago today. Among those with Hawaii ties killed in the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, Georgine Rose Corrigan, Richard Keene, Miley Hale, Michael Collins, Rich YC Lee, Patricia Pitchford Colliner, David Lachek, Christine Snyder, and Heather Ho.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
Earlier in the show, we quizzed you on Honolulu's longest-serving mayor, Frank F. Fosse, who completed six terms in office. His first term as mayor came in 1968 when he defeated D.G. Andy Anderson. An interesting fact is that he's often remembered for is that he ran as a Democrat in his first three mayoral campaigns, but after losing the primary to 1980 in Eileen Anderson, he switched parties, going on to win three more terms under the Republican banner. In the many offices that Fosse campaigned, only one race was a special election. It was when he ran against more than three dozen other candidates, including Colleen Hanabusa and Ed Case, hoping to represent the people of Hawaii in the 2nd District seat in the 108th Congress. The result of that race was incumbent Case winning with 43% of the vote. We had no winners, and you know that stumped me too. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Working with runaway teens or homeless youth in Waikiki, Carla Hauser saw a void that desperately needed to be filled. About a month ago, a new facility, a group home for teens, opened its doors in Windward, Oahu. Call it Project Rise. Carla Hauser joined us in studio to talk about its early success.
It actually stands for Residential Youth Services and Empowerment. And the beauty about that word empowerment is it really is youth-driven. It's what do they think they need in order to elevate themselves out of poverty, whether it's education, whether it's employment. We're really, as the staff and the agency there, to guide them, put a roof over their head, and then give them the resources and the referrals to the things that they need to do to elevate out of homelessness and create a better life for themselves.
Now, this program was created out of an experience that you had working at the Waikiki Health Center. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my experience at the Yo House, the drop-in center, was probably one of the greatest and yet most frustrating experiences I've ever had. Here it is. You have this tiny little house that is able to provide so many wonderful resources for youth when they're in crisis. And, you know, the one piece that was always missing was where do they go at night when we close the doors after we've provided all the medical care and the food and the basic needs? There's still that shelter piece that was missing. And having it be a very low barrier, we're not going to ask you a lot of questions, but just give you a safe place to just sleep. And so that's really kind of where this project came from, was to address that particular need that we have. A lot of the data through Point in Time, through, you know, the Homeless Youth Street Survey that UH Center on the Family did, showed us that this population, this transition age youth population of 18 to 24, you know, there are high numbers on our streets, and they are living unsheltered, meaning they weren't accessing IHS or Next Step Shelter for a number of different reasons. That's where a lot of the adults are that they don't want to be near. That's where, you know, it's often a scary place for a young person who's, you know, experienced trauma or harm at the hands of an adult. A lot of times they don't like the rules. They don't like being told they have to, you know, what they have to do. And so they were choosing to not seek shelter and instead being in our parks, being in abandoned buildings, sleeping in cars. And that's, you know, a demographic that we up until now hadn't really addressed. So we're really excited that RISE can specifically target that population of 18 to 24 year olds in a very adolescent specific approach, you know, understanding that they are still developing. They do still have a lot of very adolescent specific needs, whether it's around substance abuse, whether it's around mental illness, behavioral health, medical needs. And so to be able to provide that for them and to provide those referrals for them has really been eye-opening at just how quickly the young people are able to elevate themselves out of their situation.
And so you folks have a, like, you know, group home, I guess, sure, on the Windward side. Mm-hmm. So what's your capacity at?
Yeah, so we're actually located on the 400-acre Kawailoa Youth and Family Wellness Center that came about because of the legislation that passed this year. And so we were able to, working with the Office of Youth Services, basically repurpose the 400 acres that was previously the youth correctional facility. And, you know, through brilliant efforts through the judiciary and Office of Youth Services and a lot of the youth providers, we've been able to create a lot of diversion programs. We've stopped incarcerating young people because we've seen it doesn't work. All it does is create this, you know, creates a young person and teaches them how to be an adult criminal. And so being able to create this more therapeutic model that includes vocational opportunities, something that we can provide residential mental health facilities actually for our young people here in Hawaii. The current model is if we have somebody that really needs intensive residential mental health, behavioral health, we ship them to the mainland. And so here it is, we finally have this opportunity to create this. And so one of those, like one of the buildings on this property, we were able to refurbish and turn it into a two-tiered housing model that is kind of a mix of emergency beds, and that's our first tier, and that's for our young people who are still not sure about adults. They don't really want to engage. They don't want to do regular case management, but we provide them a safe place. Just come in. You can sleep here. It's nothing over the top fancy.
Just a crash pad.
Just basically, yeah, it's a cot with a footlocker, and so we're able to provide 8 beds for men and women total. And it's really peer driven because after they get a few nights sleep, which all of the research and all of our just basic understanding is that when you get some sleep, you make better decisions when you're not constantly worried about your safety. And so it's been really eye-opening to see them kind of come out of their cot, start looking around, and start seeing their peers who maybe were also in the encampment with them at one point, starting to kind of pull themselves up. And so then the second tier of our program is they actually get their own private bedroom with a nice twin bed, a dresser, very youth-friendly, you know, furnishings. And so once they've made that next step, whether it's, you know, where they're going to become employed, they're going to, you know, revisit finishing their high school diploma or enroll in college or whatever that next step is for them, that's the really great part of it, is it's whatever empowers them to want to make the another choice for themselves. And then, you know, we have a great common area, and so our young people learn a lot of the basic independent living skills, you know, how to cook, how to, you know, take care of your basic health needs. They learn how to shop properly. You know, we don't spend EBT at 7-Eleven. We go to the grocery store. So a lot of different just coming of age things that, you know, it's really hard to learn in an encampment when you're fending for yourself.
Right, but these are important life skills.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we've seen it a number of times where we try and take, you know, a homeless youth like directly from an encampment, from the streets, and try and place them into housing. And they'll do things like, you know, be boiling water and the pan's hot and they set it down on the ground. And, you know, in an encampment, that's fine. But in a house, you burn a giant hole in the linoleum. And so, you know, to be able to just minor things. Right. And so that's really, I think, one of the beautiful things is watching our house full of 20 young people right now kind of come together and teach each other, learn from each other, and just allow staff to kind of participate and chime in and really just kind of offer suggestions as we all know, if you've had a teenager in your life, is the phrase, "I think you should," doesn't fly with young people. And so we get creative in how we present some choices for them and just really get to sit back and watch them soar. It's been really fun.
So you basically have got this going still early on, yep. But it's created. It's at capacity now. Mm-hmm. What's next?
You know, we have this 5-year plan. We know that there is need island-wide. There's need statewide. When you look at, you know, some of the things that are going on in Kona and Maui, our plan initially was to open a second building in a year. And we've seen with just the high demand. I mean, we currently have 17 young men on our wait list waiting to get in.
Wow.
And so to have the ability to refurbish a second building on property is the direction that we're going right now. And then we want to look at different parts of the island. Right now, about 80% of the youth that are currently at RISE are from the Windward community. And that was very eye-opening. I think in my initial years with the youth outreach program, we thought, well, all kids who are, you know, homeless or on the streets, they all go to Waikiki. And we're finding, yes, a majority of them are there, but there is also great need in a number of different places on the island. So,
are there any other shelters for or group homes for kids like this on the neighbor islands?
I don't know about the neighbor islands. I know that Halekipa has run a number of excellent TLPs and independent living programs. They also run the emergency shelter for minors, those that are under 18. There's also a project in the works for the Queen Emma Street project that will hopefully service this particular population. They're still working out the details and
I know the Waikiki Health Center used to have a little wish list because I donated some of my son's, you know, caps, ball caps, and you know, shoes and backpacks when he went off to college. Do you have a wish list?
Oh, absolutely. Volunteers is probably the big one. People that are willing to come in and make a long-term commitment. We're not asking for, you know, show up every day, but if you can come once a week, you have that time. You're willing to go through the training and make a commitment. Those are always really valuable, especially as we expand our mentoring program. We want our young people to have someone in the community that, you know, they can call if, you know, their washer breaks or just something along those lines. And then we're always reaching out to different community providers, whether it's faith-based or Rotarians, for meals. We like meals that you can just kind of pop in the oven. Every night around 6 o'clock, our young people gather around a dining room table and actually have a meal together, which is so unheard of now. And things like that, a lot of youth-friendly items. We go through so much milk and so much fresh fruit and protein because these are growing boys and girls. And so we always have a need for more of your fresh food items.
Okay. And then you folks also have a fundraiser, an event.
We do. Every year. So that's one of the amazing things about RISE is that we are privately funded currently. And most of our revenue is actually driven from an annual fundraiser. We've had one on the USS Missouri. We had a sock hop at the Stan Sheriff. And so this year we're going to be at Aloha Towers on September 15th. And it's a themed, say, Bon Voyage to Youth Homelessness and a boat day theme. So we're really excited about that. Doors open at 5:30. And I believe there are still some tickets available. My fantastic board actually is handling most of that, so I'm really grateful.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for sitting down with us and giving us an insight into what's going on in the community to tackle the youth homelessness.
Thank you for having me.
That was Carla Hauser, who is at the helm of a new group home in Kailua, a shelter for homeless teenagers. That wraps it up for today. Up tomorrow, Bamboo Ridge Press launches a new book marking its 40th anniversary. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us a comment in your voice. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, go to the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.